Foundation's executive director at the time was forced to sign an unconscionable contract to stay on the air. Our antenna rent has now gone up to over $50,000 a month, four times the market rate. In the meantime, new tower space has come available for $12,000 a month. WBAI wants to be released from the next 3 years of the lease and negotiate a fair settlement.
The answer from the Empire State Building officials was that we should sell our WBAI license or trade it for one with a much smaller coverage area.
Bill Crozier is Pacifica Foundation's executive director.
In other words, they suggested that we cannibalize our signal in the largest media market in the country so they could earn excessive profits. We told them that we clearly could not do that.
You can join other listeners expressing their views about this crisis by calling 212-687-8700 and ask for Anthony Malkin. He's the CEO and board chair of Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building. You can express your views. Again, that's 212-687-8700. Ask for Anthony Malkin. And you may want to contact your city council members and local and state representatives to step in on behalf of WBAI. Many thanks.
WBAI New York. Coming up next, Vantage Point with Professor Ron Daniels.
Good morning, this is the Pepper, Dr. Ron Daniels, President of the Institute of the Black World 21st Century, and distinguished lecturer at York College, City University of New York, welcoming you to this June 26th. Yes, June 26th, summer is here and flying fast. Edition of Vantage Point here on WBAI 99.5 FM in New York, in collaboration with ycradio.org, that is the York College radio station. Well, today we have really a powerful show lined up. We are shortly going to be joined by Reverend Dennis Dillon and his new bride, his new wife and partner, Dr. Zinzile Dillon, who is from Zimbabwe in Africa, and a Pan-African connection, if you will. Going to have a lot of discussion about the economic development work that they're up to. Then we're going to shift to first time I've had an opportunity to interview Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, and she is going to be doing the keynote address for the 28th annual symposium for the International African Arts Festival. I think it's 48 years old. We'll get back to the details of that, but she's going to be the keynote speaker, and we're going to really chat with her about who is Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, actually. Get some background and what she'll be talking about, those good things. And we'll also be directing you to the activities of one of the great festivals in the entire country, the International African Arts Festival. 48 years, I think they say, that this one's going on. And then lastly, the end of Black Harlem. Well, we all know gentrification is sweeping the country. Well, Michael Henry Adams will be joining us. He wrote an article really some time ago, just came to my attention, called The End of Black Harlem. And it paints a dire picture about what is going on in the capital, the Mecca of Black America, that soon may no longer be so black at all. In fact, it's already vanishing at a rapid rate, and he's alarmed by it. And we want to chat with him about that during the course of today's show. We also just want to continue to remind people to become WBAI buddies. Really crucial. We have a pledge drive coming up, but for me, we don't have to wait for a pledge drive in order to get you on board as a sustaining contributor to WBAI. You can do that for as little as $10 per month. You can do much more if you choose, but in order to do that, and you get a bunch of goodies with that too. But the main thing is, it's painless. It's connected to your checking account, to your credit card, And it just happens. I'm a WBAI buddy. And it just happens. I'm glad. I don't have to worry about it. I don't have to worry. Did I do it? No, it happens. And that's good. So go to give2wbai.org. Also, a shout out to our internet listeners from around the country and around the world. At the end of the show, we will have an opportunity for people to call in. I hear people from various cities sometimes say they don't get a chance to get in. Well, take down this number, because for the last 20 minutes, you'll have a chance to call from wherever you are. 347-335-0818. That's 347-335-0818. And, get in line and give us a comment on our topics for the day. They are the Economic State of Black World Report, addressing the International African Arts Festival, the 28th Symposium, and the end of Black Harlem are the major topics we're going to be talking about. Also, in that last segment, we're also going to give a shout out to POP for a very successful reparations march. They've got some news, breaking news, and we'll talk a bit about the crisis that is WBAI is facing, as well as the Pacifica Network, which you just heard referenced in terms of the outrageous behavior of those who are charging us now this $50,000 per month. And we've got to somehow figure out how to back them up. Well, that's our show for today. We want to get right into it by first and foremost welcoming to the microphones the person who often co-hosts for me when I'm out of town or traveling about. The Reverend Dennis Dillon joins us. Reverend Dillon, welcome to Vantage Point.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ron. A pleasure and good morning to you. How are you on this Monday morning, sir?
I'm blessed. I'm doing quite well, sir. And we also want to introduce Dr. Zinzali Dillon, who is traveling with you. Dr. Zinzali Dillon, affectionately called Dr. Z, how are you this morning?
How are you, Dr. Ron Daniels? It's great to be on the show. Thank you so much.
Good. Well, we want to get right into it by first and foremost having Reverend Dillon introduced to our WBAI listening audience in New York, but also globally, since we're streaming live all over the country and all over the world. Would you please, Reverend Dillon, sort of introduce your wife and partner and all that good stuff to our audience?
Yeah, Dr. Ron, I thought you just did.
No, but we want you to say something about her, and you know,
this is
a big development. We're all excited. So introduce her by telling us who she is.
Well, I thank you. The Lord is good. He has blessed me with this beautiful African queen, born in Zimbabwe. And of course, she resides in South Africa, Johannesburg, South Africa. Works for one of the world's largest bank, representing most of the continent of Africa as it relates to public sector investments and things of that nature. So God is good, and I'm grateful to her. She's truly an awesome woman of God, and. Right now, we're all the way in San Francisco on one of the many missions that she does, traveling all across the globe.
Okay. All right. He's being somewhat modest. So I was at the Brooklyn Christian Center for the introduction of the State of Economic Black World Report, and I had the honor of meeting Dr. Z, and she made a presentation, and she also was very, very active and engaged in a very, very major way. And I said before, she's already affectionately called by the Brooklyn Christian Center constituency and its allies, Dr. Z. So we're not going to talk to Dr. Z now. And Dr. Z, we need you to speak up a little louder because you sound a little soft out there. So we want you to be bold and strong as we talk to our WBAI listening audience. So Dr. Z, tell us about a little bit more about your background. Born in Zimbabwe, you're very much involved in economic development. How did you come to get into this area of economic development?
Dr. Ron, economic development is an area that I've always wanted to be involved in, especially on the continent, where I've always wanted to be part of a contributor to the Africa development, especially economic development. If you look, the way I got involved is one through my banking background, where I've been a banker for over 30 years. I've worked both for the Reserve Bank, Reserve Bank in Zimbabwe, but also Reserve Banks in Eastern Southern Africa, working with different Reserve Banks, helping them with their risk management and also audit environments within the treasury area, where, you know, Reserve Banks have got so many reserves, reserves in the form of foreign reserves and gold reserves. And I help them, within their strategy to make sure that reserves are effectively managed, by those countries. And then I also transitioned in, commercial and then corporate and investment banking, where I am currently at the moment looking after public sector across the whole continent, of course, excluding South Africa, but also, in the area of corporate and investment banking, helping different countries across the continent with their investment strategies in terms of how can they fund the infrastructure development. Most of the countries across the continent, most of the governments, their fiscal space is really contracting. They don't have enough funds to invest in their Africa, infrastructure development programs. As you may know, Dr. Ron, Africa has never been this far before. There are so many investment programs across the continent. Across the continent, excluding South Africa, the continent will need about $100 billion every year to invest and to close the investment infrastructure gap. So that's a lot of money. And, of course, this calls for innovative financing solutions, which I do work with different governments to make sure that given their fiscal space constraints, they are still able to close their investment gap through innovation, through innovative financing solutions. It can be in the form of public-private partnerships. So that's really what I do. If we look at the African Union, they have they've identified the Africa diaspora as one of the regional economic investment communities. So this really calls for our African brothers and sisters in diaspora across the globe, including America, which is really where a lot of them are, and the Caribbean, to come back home and partner on the ground with our African leaders, as well as African companies, to help Africa rise. There's also the Africa Rising narrative that has been out there. The heads of states came together and they got the Africa Rising narrative going. It's more like a rally call, calling for different African people to come together. Let's help together. Let's work together and help Africa rise. And of course, the Africa Africans in diaspora are also being called through that acknowledgement of them being part of the investment community. So, in a nutshell, that's what I do. But again, from a faith base, I do have this organization called Marketplace Calling International. It's a gathering of Christian business people across the globe, where we are saying, let's come out of our four walls, our churches, let's connect at a global scale, pan-African scale, and let's connect for greater economic impact. The vision is to raise kings who actually have dominion in the marketplace. Where we are saying the church has been pretty much synonymous with poverty, and you know, I'm sure we've all heard about the proverb which says, "As poor as a church mouse." And I'm saying we really need to change that. How can Christians and believers play in the mainstream economy for greater economic impact? So MCI, it has got presence in Johannesburg. We are in Cape Town. We are in East London. That's in South Africa. Those three locations are in South Africa. We are also in Zambia, Lusaka. We are in Kenya, Nairobi. We are in Harare, Zimbabwe. And outside that, we are also in New York. That's in the U.S. We are in Silicon Valley, which is why we are here in Silicon Valley. We are also in London, in the U.K., and we just meet together, and we look at investment opportunities. We also look at networking and empowering one another through exchange of experiences and exchange of opportunities. So in summary, that's what I do.
Well, what an awesome summary. And again, one could see why Reverend Dennis Dillon would be blessed to have encountered you for this powerful Pan-African couplage, if you will. And
I'm super blessed.
I am announcing and proclaiming you are super blessed. And we could spend a lot of time in another setting. I'll ask her why and how she became attracted to you. I think I could understand it, but God is looking after you, my brother. God is definitely looking after you.
Yeah, he sure is.
Well, Reverend Dillon, talk to us now about the state of Economic Black World Report, which is, by the way, such a beautiful document. Just the design of it is so beautiful and compelling. Obviously, in the little time that we have, we can't cover the entire report. You spent a great deal of time in very interesting and exciting and challenging presentation at the Brooklyn Christian Center when this was released over a week ago now. What are some of, let's start with where Dr. Z ended. One of the things that you talk about is the tremendous economic growth in Africa. Would you, contrary to what some people might believe, Africa is one of the leading, I mean, its countries have some of the leading economies in the world. Speak to that.
Yeah, well, good place to start. I think it's important for us to know overall that, black people are rising to a greater place of economic power across the globe. And it's exciting because when we look at Africa and we see the growth in Africa, according to the World Bank, according to the United Nations, is the fastest growing continent in the world, and the growth is extremely rapid. But not only is Africa the fastest growing continent in the world, African Americans, Dr. Ron, is the fastest growing population in the United States of America. Another critical point, and by the way, the report is available for those who want to get it. The youngest population in the United States of America, according to the U.S. Census, happens to be blacks. And the youngest population in the world happened to be on the continent of Africa. So here's the way we have to posture this. Not only do we see massive growth, population growth taking place on the continent and among Africans in the United States or blacks in the United States of America, our population is the youngest. whites have a much older population in America than blacks, and blacks have a larger young population in the United States than blacks. So I think that's just one critical place for us to start. And I think Dr. Z, my beautiful wife, talked about the connection between Africa and the United States of America. The buying power of blacks in America has grown rapidly, and by the way, the fastest growing economy as it relates to what we would call per capita GDP in America happens to be blacks. When we measure that and we begin to understand that, we begin to see this massive rise and this economic growth that's taking place. $1.7 trillion is what the economic state of New York and of course the United States reported that we will see in terms of growth taking place. We've looked at data coming from the University of Georgia, their Department of Economic Forecasting, which is our prime source of data as it relates to population growth in the United States. And we're seeing this massive growth, this massive energy. Then one of the very critical points that is important for us to understand, when we look at the fastest growing economies in the world, and we're talking about countries now, so the Worldometer and again other global data sources have looked at economies that are growing. The fastest growing economy in the world happens to be Ethiopia. Over the past 5 years, they've experienced a 9.7% growth, followed by the Democratic Republic of the Congo, followed by the Ivory Coast, followed by Mozambique, followed by Rwanda, followed by Tanzania. And then there are five Asian economies that follow those six African economies as it relates to world growth. So it's exciting just to see the economic growth that's taking place across the continent and among black folks globally. It is for us now to make sure that we can stem the tide of the kind of economic exploitation that's taking place on the continent, and how we as blacks in America can begin to develop a Nehemiah strategy to go home, go back to Africa, and help build and help take advantage of some of the resources that's there in the interest of our global population.
Well, Reverend Dillon, again, very, very exciting in terms of that. Another layer is the tremendous number of African and by both African-American or people of African descent on the continent. Not millionaires, but billionaires who have emerged. Talk about that a minute, if you will.
Yeah, and I think that's also a very key critical point. We've been doing this report for, I think, maybe about 18 or so years. And as we reflect upon the report 20 years ago, the world only had one black billionaire. We've seen, and that's Robert Johnson, the former CEO and, of course, the founder of BET Television. Today, we have 40, our report identified, and it's all in the Economic State of Black New York report, 40 billionaire and the 50 richest blacks in the world, according to our report, have amassed, listen to this, growth wealth of well over $140 billion. So we're not where we were 20 years ago. We've seen this massive rise of wealth. When today a black man, Mr. Dangote, who is the president for the Dangote Corporation, the Dangote Cement Company in Nigeria, is among the third richest people in the world. So things are changing. The landscape is changing. And if I may add, Ron, not only are we seeing that level of growth on the economic side, When we look on the face side, the report also identified the 25 largest black churches in the world. And when you look at these 25 churches, there's a revival, a spiritual revival that's taking place among blacks across the globe. Just imagine that the largest church in Europe is pastored by an African. Imagine that the largest church in the former USSR area, you know, Russia, that is pastored by an African. So we're seeing this. The largest church auditorium in the world is in Nigeria. The largest church cathedral in the world is in Côte d'Ivoire. So, wow, there is just a revival that is taking place on the economic side and on the spiritual side. And our mission and commitment and goal is to make sure that as we are growing economically, that there is a spiritual connection. And as we're growing spiritually, we understand that there can be no true spiritual revival without an economic component.
Wow. Very, very powerful information, again, in terms of how we're growing as black people across the world, across the globe. I guess there are a couple of other things I would want to ask, though, and we've got just a few minutes left, and I definitely want you to do two things before we conclude. One is to give the information where people can get the report, and also to provide information about the forthcoming summit for MCI that's coming up September 22nd or so in South Africa. So I want to make sure we get that in. But again, let me express this concern. Of course, I expressed this concern during the panel at the Brooklyn Christian Center. It's all well and good to have these black billionaires and the economic growth and whatever. For example, you mentioned the Congo, and that's a case in point. The Congo is a mess. I mean, Nigeria is this huge economy, and yet you have streams of wealth and poverty. So how does this wealth, because for me as a professor and a theoretician, you know, a sort of social philosopher, if you will, to me the question is really not, the growth is important, but equally as important is distribution. This is when I talk to my classes, I always talk to them, there are two issues. What's the nature of wealth? But the key question is what's the question is distribution. Because if it's all centered in the hands of a few, if it's only enriching the upper echelons of society, then what we see is the resources of the richest continent in the world sort of aggregating to a few while the masses are suffering. How do we overcome that?
I think it is critical for us to, again, and this is the reason why I truly believe that the spiritual component is critical. I think we have to be guided by something deeper than the search for gold, the desire for diamond, the drilling of oil, and of course the desire for money. I think the balance, Ron, is that we as black folks largely have this deep social consciousness that for the most part we're not focused on making money like other races have been. And obviously we're seeing a change in that regard. I think it's important that this is tempered by a deep moral consciousness. And I believe that this moral consciousness needs to be guided because that there's an inculcation of God consciousness amongst us. And my whole desire is to see the church, to see even the mosque and the temples, to see the spiritual faith leaders with a level of consciousness and understanding are at the forefront of this. What we have seen in other economies and in other countries and in other cultures and races and settings, we have oftentimes seen the establishment of economic infrastructure around some spiritual and moral foundation. And so there's always a giving back, and there's always this social entrepreneurship or this what I would call ecclesiastical entrepreneurship that guides other community. And my thrust is for this to be an important part of what we're doing. I was so impressed, the number 40 of the richest person in the world, who happens to be Strive, I have difficulties pronouncing his last name right now, out of Zimbabwe. He owns the largest telecommunication company in Zimbabwe and across parts of southern Africa. And we sat there with the CEO, and they wanted to start the meeting with prayer. And when we were through, they asked us to pray for them. I believe that that's one of the first, and forgive me, folks, if from your perspective, over-spiritualizing this, but I think it is so important for this moral compass to be rooted in a greater level of spirituality. Because when we look at the German revival, Martin Luther and a host of others who started it, that spiritual revival created economic power and economic strength. Then we moved to the French revival, spiritual revival. We saw the same dynamics, economics being wrapped around it. We moved to the British revival, the same thing. And despite the fact that these economies or these countries were to a great degree driven by monies and driven by greed to the level that they created a system that we call the slave trade, and they've colonized the world to get to where they are. I believe that we need to birth this Africa revival, this rising of Africa on a strong spiritual plane, and don't make the mistake that these other countries, particularly these countries in Europe, made by exploiting other people and other lands to get to where they are.
Right. Well, I'm certainly with you on that, and certainly that's my voice is going to consistently be there. And of course, during the course of my presentation, I quoted Martin Luther King as he talked about the need for a revolution of values, the need to move from a thing-oriented society to a person-oriented society. So we have within the African framework, really, the African worldview, this non-exploitive sort of way of doing things. And to the degree that we can center it both in the moral and ethical and spiritual, it seems to me that we'll be on the right track. We have about a minute left, so would you please, first and foremost, share with people the information about the MCI Summit in South Africa and a website or phone number where people can call about that. And I suppose that's probably the same way that they can get the Economic State of the Black World report as well.
Yeah, so we're excited about this trip to South Africa. We certainly want to invite as many listeners as possible to join us in Johannesburg. It will be the 22nd, the 21st, the 22nd of September. 22nd, 23rd, rather, we will be in Johannesburg. We are planning, by the way, Dr. Ron, we don't want folks to make a trip all the way to South Africa just for 2 days. So we're planning about 4 or 5 days of activities in Soweto, going to the Cradle of Humankind, going to the Apartheid Museum, and other places, go to Mandela House, possibly go to Desmond Tutu's house, go and just see some of this beautiful place. Now I understand why South Africa has been the way it is over the year. And by the way, there's still what we call economic apartheid that's in South Africa. So it is so key. When we talk about, we're gathering at this summit, many of the multi-millionaires and billionaires, Ron, have already committed to being at this summit that will be in Johannesburg. So right. We will be talking businesses, networking, and coming together. And it will be at the Sandton Convention Center in Johannesburg. So we want to invite folks to come, some key leaders out of the United States will be joining, because this is a connection of America and Africa for the empowerment of Africa and Africans globally. That's really our thrust. The phone number for folks to call will be 718, and I suggest that folks call later on this afternoon, tomorrow. Please get the report. The number 718-638-6397. Again, that number 718-638-6397. And I definitely want to invite folks to email us at info@marketplacecalling.com. They can email for information, and they can call and say, listen, we want to be a part of this. And they can certainly come tonight to our special meeting, Monday nights at 1061 Atlantic Avenue, and pick up copies of the Economic State of the Black World Report there at 1061 Atlantic Avenue as well.
All right, Reverend Dennis Dillon. So now I know I have two guests that can really talk. It can really lay it out. So I got Dr. Z and I got Reverend Dillon, because plenty of information. So don't be surprised if I call on Dr. Z in and of herself and by herself as a awesome, powerful leader. And it's so good
please
to see
do,
women, frankly, who are taking these roles. I mean, highly accomplished. As I listen to her background, treading and moving in all of these circles with these, you know, bankers and entrepreneurs and so forth, that is an incredible kind of model that we certainly need our daughters and men to see in terms of that kind of leadership. So, my dear brother, you are truly blessed, and we're delighted to have this dynamic Pan-African couple together. So thank you both for being with us this morning, and we wish you well in your discussions in Silicon Valley.
Thank you, sir, and God bless you, Dr. Ron, and keep up the great work.
Thank you very much. All right, that Reverend Dennis Dillon and Dr. Zenzele Dillon, what a dynamic couple that is. We're going to take a break, come back, and we're going to hear from Dr. Rosalind Jeffries. We'll be right back after this break.
George Orwell's classic novel 1984 was written as a warning. Today, it's used as a playbook.
Do you believe in God, Winston? No. Then what is it, this principle that will defeat us? I don't know. The spirit of man? And do you consider yourself a man? Yes. If you are a man, Winston, you are the last man.
Tune in Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour Pacifica National broadcast of our classic 1975 cover-to-cover marathon reading of 1984 on your Pacifica station. That's Tuesday, June 27th for an all-day 15-hour marathon broadcast.
Okay, well, we're back, and what an incredible interview that was that we just had with Reverend Dennis Dillon, and of course his partner, Reverend Dr. Zinzile Dillon. And now we've been anxiously awaiting this interview with none other than the better half of the Dr. Leonard Jeffries sort of tandem. She's always at his side and always with him as he travels all over the world and various other pursuits. But a leader, scholar, researcher, and, you know, in her own right. And she's going to be the keynote speaker for the forthcoming NACO Symposium at the International African Arts Festival. And so I said, we need to interview Mrs. J, because I've never had the pleasure of doing that. So, Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, welcome to Vantage Point.
Indeed, thank you very much. Pleasure for me to be with you, especially because over the years, I have been following you and the wonderful things, important things that you have been doing with the state of the race, informing thousands of us exactly what's happening at our particular time, whatever time it is, you're able to analyze and codify for us. And what you don't do, you bring in those experts who can give us the updated view to look toward the future.
Well, we certainly appreciate that, and appreciate your participation in it. Let's get right to it. Let's get to some background in terms of Dr. Rosalind Jeffries. Are you a native New Yorker? Where were you born? Give us a little bit about your background so that people who are out there who see you around speaking and traveling with Dr. J and all that. But sometimes we don't really know really sort of the background of everybody. So I always like to start there. Tell us about yourself a little bit. You know, where were you born and a little bit about your upbringing and that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. I was born in Harlem Hospital and raised in Harlem on 115th Street between Lenox and Fifth Avenue, which means that I was born impacted with culture on top of culture of black peoples, and also not far from Spanish Harlem and a junior high school that was like the United Nations, because in those days you had Italians on First Avenue and Irish, and you had dispersed throughout Chinese, and a lot of people were coming in from South America, different parts, so that the junior high school I went into was indeed heavily international. I remember crying for a week because the part of the block that I lived on was impacted totally black. The elementary school that I went to, PS 184, was Harlem apartheid. All of the students black, all of the teachers white. And I loved living all black, because to me that was the essence of black people and the black, it was post-Harlem Renaissance, and so I had that mood of the classical. And then when it was Daddy Grace, Father Divine, so you know what that means. It means I knew about umbrella cultures and rolling out the red carpet, so that by the time I got to Ghana, it was natural for me. I knew about the economics because we had Daddy Grace, who had land upstate and was buying hotels, et cetera, et cetera. I remember looking in the door of the Daddy Grace Temple, and a whole wall was full of money. They paste the money bills all over because of the economics that was, you know, that we had. People say that we didn't do anything, but it's not true. There's a book, Collective, by Jessica Gordon, and she talks about, at the turn of the century and after slavery, the large numbers of cooperatives that we had and what they were doing, and those were the kinds of things that went into Tulsa. So I grew up in a very, very rich background with all of this, so that eventually when I started teaching a course, which I still teach now, called Race and Ethnic Relations, is the kind of course that I walk in there with a lot of the Koreans, Japanese, and Chinese, people from Israel, from everywhere all over the world. And after knowing African-American history and our origin, I can literally stand up there and say, I am your mother. And so that when the new people are coming into America, those people who are immigrants, they don't know who we are, our background. They don't know that we died and went up against billy clubs and against the water hoses and falling down and getting your skull cracked and all kinds of things like that. What for not just black people, for all people, we organized in those kinds of things so that they could walk into any hotel they want to today. And so all of multicultural America needs to know they can go into any hotel as long as they got the money, they can come in. They can go into any restaurant in America as long as they have the money, they can go in. They can go into any library at a time that, you know, Hidden Figures, when we couldn't go into the libraries like we wanted to. We laid the foundation for the interchanges of multicultural. Hello?
Yeah, we're still there.
Oh, okay.
I'm just listening.
So that these are some of the things that we need to bring out in the contemporary right now for the generations that are coming and are integrating without knowing our full background and the contributions that we have made.
Education.
And so, education. So that, I'm saying that my multicultural background and my background loving black people from a full all black environment was, a very special thing. The Nation of Islam, as you remember, on 115th Street, on then Lenox Avenue, is where Malcolm X used to stand. And so Temple No. 7 grew out of a lot of the dispersal of the people when the projects were built. That area was torn down where Daddy Grace was, and then there was a new building project, and some of the people that were lost went into becoming part of the Temple No. 7. And so I would see Cassius Clay back then through the window and gloat over how handsome he was, etc., and loved the fact that the Islamic women wore the long dresses, and all of that impacted me at a very, very early age. And I was around there too when Elijah Muhammad wanted to fly us all into Chicago, and we were on that plane. And then around the corner, 116th Street, is where the Yoruba Temple or Surgiman and his people had moved. So that's why I'm saying I had all of that background, so that in 1960, when I went with Operation Crossroads Africa, the Presbyterian minister, James Robinson, to Africa, when I got there, I didn't get culture shock because I had the marketplace where my mother would send us to sell blouses at Marqueta on in Spanish Harlem. I had such a tremendous background already until it was quite unbelievable. Then I had a cousin who would come over, and he would, his name was Robert Bradford. He was kind of like in that Paul Robeson classical Marian Anderson kind of tradition. He belonged to a company that he would travel singing operatics in Europe and then coming back. And he was our tutor, so that before, I my fingers were big enough to do an octave, I was playing the piano in those old days, like you heard about Farrakhan with his violin. I was playing the piano, so that down in Town Hall, I was eventually, with her little group of students, able to play Claire de Lune. And so I grew up with classical, even in the school that I went to. It was a good school. So we learned Edgar Allan Poe and all of the Byron Shelley Keats. But at the same time, I would come home and we had doo-wop on the block. So we had, what would become, you know, your B.B. King and all of that down home, you know. So that when, and I also had the artists when they came along. This was the time when Charles Alston had done the murals with Africans in it, African sculptures in the murals for Harlem Hospital, and got all of the flack behind that, the post, you know, Harlem Renaissance. I had the Jacob Lawrences at the County Cullen, the Aaron Douglases, and so that this idea of what is Africa and what is African art, it was part of my upbringing. My stomping ground was the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the American Museum of Natural History, the Statue of Liberty, the boat ride. My mother would take us on these things. And then, of course, the opera house that my cousin would take us to. So, but we had authentic down home. I spoke Gullah Geechee.
Mm.
I didn't even speak English, you know, in elementary school every time. But I do had a great teacher that taught me how to speak English, that I wasn't speaking English. I can do something. I can do, you know, those kinds of things in the Ebonics. And I remember this teacher pulling me aside, saying, "Silk," and she was a nasty teacher, "ING, don't you see ING? And so that I am quick to say people who speak Bronxese or Brooklynese to say that, no, you have to be bilingual, speak English in order right. to navigate the society. And so it was still rich because one parent was from Sumter, South Carolina, and Sumter considered itself, you know, very classical somewhat. And then the other parent was from Horatio out into the woods. And so when the poverty periods came around, we never had trouble because they sent us these boxes and cases and things up from the South. I remember them sending up chickens. And my mother, you know, knew how she would ride horses, and she was quite a fancy lady, but she knew all of the Southern folklore and scare us to death with the Carolina folk stories, et cetera, and the old culture. So I am right now interested in the mixtures of old and new. When they named me in Africa, my first trip was 1960 in Nigeria. That was my first trip way up country. We got a shower when it showered, and it did shower every day very hard, like you turned on a faucet. And so I remember people dying in my presence because there wasn't any penicillin around. A woman was giving birth and died. That Africa and African American was there with me at those early stages. And of course, in 1960, I came back and from Africa, and people got tired of hearing me talk Africa, Africa. You didn't have the Africa you have today with Bogolanfini, Bogoland on 116th Street, the African Market, and the Senegalese, you know, kind of like taking over, so to speak, wonderfully around those areas. And so I came talking, and I opened up this big trunk of African art in the living room on 115. My mother hollered, "Get this voodoo out of here." And so I said, but I'm an artist. And we see, you know, the art was in the Romy Beard and the Jacob Lawrence and stuff like that. So she said, "Oh, okay." So because the African art was in the paintings, you know, I was able to begin to look at the culture of Africa in that way from a very Orthodox-like family that lived on 115th Street. So that, strangely enough, I had been given names in Africa amongst the Yoruba and also the Akan, Yamide, which meant, you know, reconciliation between Islam and Christianity, and also old grandmother has returned. And Ese Ibebio was a name I was given in Stulmet in Ghana. Ese Ibebio means to return, to come back. And they said, told me my name meant grandmother has returned, come back. So, and at the time they gave me these names, I didn't like it at all because I considered myself, a young, dapper lady in and out of things. And so that was not a good name for me. But as time went on, I saw that it was perfect because of the interest in old antiquities. And even the stuff I wrote for Ivan Van Sertima, it was cave art and information about cave art that people were not accustomed to saying, etc. So it was delving in the research of old things. And then at the same time, even now, School of Visual Arts, I'm down with the filmmakers. That's what I teach, people who are filmmakers, animators, cartoonists, illustrators. Somehow or other, God did not move me out of that region, knowing that the visual arts and the computers is the future of where we're traveling and where we are going. And so that eventually I went to Yale University for a PhD, and I think it was part of the destiny that was already laid out for me. From childhood. In my childhood, my family was Baptist. My father was Methodist, and from that kind of training, I was a Baptist Sunday school teacher. So that from an early age, it was the presence of the Lord that I felt that came to me in a time when I thought I was going to die, that I had trouble and whatnot, and a spirit of the Lord jumped off the Bible and started to teach me. And that was the same spirit, I would say, that pushed me into Yale. And so, and when I was up in Yale under Robert Ferris Thompson and also Blasingame was the one that was the expert in African-American history, because they had said, well, no, you can't do art history of African Americans, you have to do America, and then you have to do Africa, and then you're on your own, you can find your way if you please, you know, with African Americans. But that learning Africa, I remember studying the heavy Nkisis with looking some, you know, very menacing statues that said with a nail in them. And I said, Lord, you really want me to study this? Yes, I'm there. And so my mission has been all along to work in museums and around original sculptures and things and separating the wheat from the chaff, so that there's such a thing in contemporary, which is what Segun wants me to do at the festival, to talk in terms of what is cultural pollution amongst us versus what is authentic culture. And because so many of us are lost in not understanding things, there's a new movement called the New Black. We had the New Negro in the Harlem Renaissance period, but then you have these new blacks who say that it's okay to learn a little bit of black history, etc., but you just use it, you know, and abuse it. It's okay because that's what the society does. And so that's an interesting kind of a concept. And in the abstraction of everything, you can be kind of like stick your nose in the air and do abstractions and what's called essentialism or constructivism and all kinds of fancy terms. Some of them come from Plato. And within these abstractions, you can kind of like just be beyond black. That was the term that, and narcissistic, without going to the depth of what Africa really means. And so that I end up always going to the essentials, the real essential. So that what is the difference between fake money and the fraud and authentic money? You don't spend your time studying the fraud as much as you study the authentic, and then you'll know touching the money by the way it feels, the ink on the money, the exactness of the etchings of the portraits and the symbols. You start knowing exactly what it is. You can almost pick up fake money and know it's fake. You can take a quick glance and you know certain little dots and tittles, so to speak, are not in its proper place. And so that's what I can begin to go back and do as I walk in the various museums. I worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art full time at one time, year in and year out. And there were some times I went in there, I was there 6 days a week, didn't know what the weather was like outside. And so that was very special because you don't have many Afrocentric people like myself in places in those kinds of museum settings. So I actually did curatorial work. I would go into stacks and create an exhibition, borrowing works like I did for the an exhibition in Roslyn, Long Island, you still there?
Yeah, I'm listening.
Yes, okay. I did an exhibition on contemporary art and African traditional art, and I lined up the languages of Africa at a time when people were not saying too much about written languages in Africa. So we had the Merowe script, certainly, in Nubia, and we had the Merenetcha from ancient Egypt. We had a language in Somali, a written language they had, and certainly Ge'ez, 500 B.C. in Ethiopia, that turned into and fed Amharic. We had the Avai script in Liberia. In Cameroon, there was a formal writing script. And when the French came in, they found the people with a printing press and things already in print. So some of these kind of parallels and things, people should come on July 1st to Commodore Perry Park because that will be the 46th annual International African Arts Festival where Brother Segun is definitely one who has been working on this and organizing this, bringing in Milana Karanga and Kawaida and all of mixing it with the cultures of New York and all around. People would come from the South, and we expect people to come from every place in order to participate in this. And so that my diaspora culture bringing things back, because many of the contemporary artists don't know the full background of what has been brought out into all of these many conferences that we go to. And so the dimension of who we are has to be brought out. As I mentioned, with those people who are immigrants coming in and don't know who we are, it's almost like a crime shame. We were organized. We weren't just a bunch of people marching and hollering and screaming and sitting in and laying down. People would not have been able to go to all of these colleges. A lot of whites now are in the black colleges in the South. But we open up those doors. Mega Evers had to be killed. Others had to be killed. Ruby Ridge, trying to go to school and the busing, etc. We had SCLC, we had CORE, we had SNCC, we had NAACP, we had CAP, Community Action Programs, we had MFDP, the Mississippi Freedom Democratic Party, we had COFO, the Council of Federated Organizations, CF,
yes.
On and on and on and on.
Right.
We had Ron Daniels.
Well, I don't know about me, but I just let you roll, and I'm glad to let you roll because you gave us so much background and so much richness. Now I got to bring you back and do at least another half hour because I didn't even get to all my questions, and the background was so powerful because it lets us know a part of what your keynote address is going to be about on this coming Saturday, on July 1st, that is, I'm sorry, 9:30 to 4:30 is the symposium. It's the one that's put on by NACO every year. I think it's the 28th of the symposium.
Oh, it's, okay. I don't know why it said 45th annual international.
I'll get the corrected version in a minute. It's about, I think it's the 46th year, but the symposium is
the 28th symposium.
That's been put on. It's at PS 287. That's 50 Navy Street. And of course, you can go to the internet, and you can, you know, you can get all of the information at info at IAAFestival.org. IAAFestival.org. Or you can call 718-638-6700. We'll get back to you near the end of the program to reiterate that. But the most important thing is, and there will be many speakers, and all of them are important, but you can hear from all of this extraordinary information and background and history and the synthesis of it, that this very powerful woman that's quiet, and you see her at different events, and she's at the side of Dr. J, it's like the old folks say, she has a lot going on and is a powerhouse in her own right. And that's what we wanted to showcase, that this is on her own and of herself, an incredible intellect, great researcher, powerful leader that has a powerful, informed, in-depth, African-centered message that is going to be delivered as the keynote address at the International African Arts Festival here on July 1st. So, Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, we thank you much. We got to bring you back because I didn't even get to how you met Dr. J and some of the highlights and all. I didn't even get to that. So I was worried that maybe a half an hour, how do you feel all that? But you filled the whole half hour in a straightforward way. So that lets us know you're going to be off the charts on this coming Saturday. Thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Okay, well, we really do have to bring her back because, whew, what a phenomenal, amazing African woman Dr. Rosalind Jeffries is. I learned a lot just from that 20, 25 minutes or so. Going to take a quick break, come back, and we're going to be talking about the end of Black Harlem. The end of Black Harlem with Michael Henry Adams after we take this break.
Mike Pender, co-founder of the Moody Blues. You're listening to WBAI, New York.
Is it time to get the life feed going?
Oh, let's go!
Uno, dos. Uno, dos. Mic check, 1, 2, 1, 2. Uno, 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 uno. Mic check, 1, 1, 2. Yeah, brand new collaboration. Test move, straight face, you remember. Along with the voice of Harlem. Knock, knock. Who is it? The voice of Harlem. I came to visit. And I can't stay long. Long enough to lay a song.
Okay, we're back, and wow, that's like turned on the reel and just let Dr. Rosalind Jeffries roll. What a powerful, powerful interview. We will have to bring her back because I could have spent the whole hour with her. What an amazing amount of information. I always like to do that. I want to get people's background because I've known Dr. Rosalind Jeffries for all these many years, but I don't really know her, really, in terms of the background and what goes into her and what makes her up and who makes her the person she is. And I dare say there are many in our listening audience who were not aware of all that makes up this powerful, powerful, powerful African woman. Now we turn to the topic of the end of Black Harlem. I was delighted to have a conversation with Michael Henry Adams the other day about this, as I was able to finally have his article sent to me, and it was quite compelling. So we welcome to Vantage Point now the author of a piece entitled The End of Black Harlem, Michael Henry Adams. Welcome to Vantage Point.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Just sort of still on a high from a couple of very, very powerful interviews, not the least of which was Dr. Rosalind Jeffries, who's we just had a conversation with. But we now want to turn to you, and I'm just meeting you, frankly. Someone sent me your article the other day, and it was sent as if it was like new, and so I was saying, wow, and I was looking at my New York Times, I didn't see it. I just, you know, there's so many different versions these days. But whether it was sent done the other day or a year ago to me was kind of irrelevant. It was so powerful in terms of what it means in relationship not only to Harlem, but what's happening all over the United States of America again, one might say. But let's start with Michael Henry Adams. Give us a little of your background. Are you a native Harlemite, or were you born elsewhere? And just give us a little bit about yourself.
No, like Langston Hughes and all the best Harlemites. I'm originally from someplace else. I'm from Akron, Ohio.
But you got to be kidding. You're from Akron, Ohio?
I'm from Akron, Ohio.
Ah,
I've lived in Harlem for 31 years. So I've lived here over half a year, past half my life. So I feel that I am a true Harlemite now. And I came to New York to study in the historic preservation program at Columbia. And when I arrived, one of the things that was shocking to me was that Harlem had all these incredible examples of late 19th and early 20th century architecture, but so little of it was protected by landmarking. And unfortunately, despite my efforts over the years, that continues to be the case. Only 3.6% of the buildings in Harlem are protected by landmarking, versus Greenwich Village, where about two-thirds of the buildings are protected by landmarking, or the Upper West Side, where about half the buildings are protected by landmarking. So this sort of discrepancy is laid to, as far as I'm concerned, simply to the notion of elitism and racism that are still at play today. And last year, the City Council passed a law, Intro 775, which makes it even more difficult to get things landmarked now, with new limitations that didn't exist when these more prosperous white neighborhoods were getting landmarking in their area. And so it really is a sad thing to me, because I feel like with the rules and the staffing of the Landmarks Commission, that it really does make it seem impossible that Harlem will ever have any kind of equality of designation in terms of eligible landmarks, that a place like Soho or Tribeca or Brooklyn Heights or other communities like that already enjoy. And that's an unfortunate thing.
So what you're saying is that this landmarking is the key to preservation. In other words, if you don't have the landmarks, it's easy to just sort of tear down historical sites. You can disappear the essence of a community if you don't have that capacity for landmarking. Am I interpreting that right?
Well, it's one tool amongst, you know, a variety of tools. First of all, a community needs, of course, to be concerned about and to care about the buildings that represents their history and their community. You know, in the early 1990s, I went to the annual convention of the National Trust, and their theme that year was cultural diversity. And the thing that was so shocking to me was that even though the theme was cultural diversity, they were holding this convention in Miami Beach, which the NAACP was boycotting Miami Beach because they had failed to receive Nelson Mandela when he'd come to Florida. And so that was ironic. But then when I was raising this issue at their plenary session, the speaker was Representative Lewis, and he said, initially, he said, well, in communities of color, that because there were fewer resources, that landmarking was problematic because oftentimes it was a question of, are you going to save an old building or are you going to create affordable housing, for instance, or are you going to create economic development or are you going to save an old building? But then I asked the question of him, I said, well, given that so oftentimes public money, tax dollars, are used to create new development in a community like Harlem, or foundation money, isn't there an even greater imperative to protect our heritage in the same way that it is in white neighborhoods? You know, if the same kind of development were happening in a white neighborhood and you were using these funds, there'd be extra scrutiny to make sure that you weren't going to impact an historic resource. And it was one of the proudest moments of my life when Representative Lewis said, you know, I'd never thought of it in that way, and of course you're right. So it's really a matter of, is our history in the form of old buildings the backdrop of our accomplishments and attainment? Is that going to be treated in the same serious way that the heritage and culture of whites is? And so that's really what's at stake. And so as more and more buildings like the Linux Lounge and the clubs, former clubs like Small's Paradise and the Ubangi Club, or things like the famous Lafayette Theater, as they are demolished in Harlem, as more and more churches are entering into partnerships with developers, where the church is demolished, a luxury condominium is built, and then the church is given some space in the ground floor and a few million dollars, and they get a few extra years of life. But given the fact that the majority of the people who are going to move into that luxury apartment building are going to be inclined to be white, given that they are contributing to this changing demographic, which is going to limit their days, isn't that a kind of reckless thing for black people to be doing, to be participating in transforming our own community and making it so that our displacement is even more likely? That's what's going on in Harlem today, and that's what's at stake. And that's why these false controversies, like the question of should developers be calling Harlem south of 125th Street SoHa, just doesn't resonate with me, because so many of the people who are saying, no, you can't call Harlem SoHa, are people who have been working hand in glove with developers to create luxury development with $7 million apartments and $3,000 a month studio apartments in a community that has a median income of $36,000 a year, which will guarantee that Harlem will ever more rapidly cease to be a primarily black community. When you're doing these things that are going to eliminate me and my community, I don't really care what you call it, because it won't be Harlem. If there are no black people in Harlem, it won't be the place that's known and celebrated throughout the world. And people said in response to my article, they said, well, that's a racist attitude. They said that the Dutch lived in Harlem, the Jews lived in Harlem, Irish people lived in Harlem.
Well, that is all true. And some of those people were even renowned and famous people, like great composers like Richard Rodgers or Lorenz Hart. But nothing that any of these other groups ever did in Harlem made it into a world-renowned, legendary community. That's only what black people did here. That's why Harlem is known so well today. So, again, I say if Harlem does not continue to be the African-American cultural capital of the world, then they can call it anything they want to, from my perspective.
Yeah, and I guess the drift of what you're saying is, which I find really interesting, and I don't know whether this is a sin of commission or omission, is that in some ways the powers that be, faith leaders, elected officials, political leaders, others, are sort of contributing to their own demise. In other words, they're either intentionally or unintentionally doing things that will result in the disappearance of Harlem as we know it today. And by the way, I would say parenthetically, for whatever, you know, these other groups also had ready access to do lots of other different things. I mean, the fact of the matter, other than Native Americans in this country, I would argue that no other group that has migrated here, well, certainly the Native Americans didn't migrate here. We were enforced captives, enslaved people who have a certain peculiar and particular history. And that sort of makes us different than the Italians and the other groups that sort of were in Harlem previously. That black people were able to create this, and to create this image, is something that one would argue should be preserved almost just for that in and of itself. You know, I don't know if you agree or not, but I'm sort of seeing that as one of the critical points. But let me just go back to my previous point. It appears that people have been contributing to their own demise. It's a part of what you're saying.
In ways big and small, and in counterintuitive ways. So, for instance, you would think that the creation of a hip-hop museum on 125th Street, that would be a good thing. And by and large, I think that's a good thing. Or you'd think that the expansion of the Studio Museum to make it a much larger building, that would be a good thing. But in doing that, they are tearing down existing buildings, which, from my perspective, even though they're buildings that were built by whites in the 1890s or the early 1900s, their identity is the identity of the authentic Harlem that Langston Hughes and Zora Neale Hurston knew. And so they have that kind of historic identity from my perspective. And they're being replaced with these things that look like something from Las Vegas or something from heaven knows where. I mean, you know, the Studio Museum, it's by the celebrated African architect David Adjaye, who everyone loves so since he's done the National African American Museum. But I say these places are visually alien to the historic Harlem and are a part of, ironically, the erasure of this place that has this black identity. And so that, too, seems to me to be a sad thing. But the greatest, when we talk about culpability, the greatest thing that you can say about black leaders, politically and religious leaders and economic leaders, all of these people, was that to look at Harlem is indicative of how little power, political power, we have ever had in America. It is a great tragedy. Now, just imagine this. When I came to New York in 1985, Harlem was on the verge of becoming a place where the city of New York, due to abandonment and a failure of landlords to maintain their buildings and to pay their property taxes and their water rates, Harlem was a place where the city would come to own something like 80% of all the housing stock. Now imagine a neighborhood like that in, say, Greenwich Village or in Park Slope, where the city owned 80% of the housing stock. Can you really believe that the politicians wouldn't have found a way to respond to their community and make sure that the people who lived in that community came to own a good portion of that 80% of city-owned housing. So that didn't happen in Harlem. Almost no black people became the owners of the place where we live in Harlem as a consequence of the city owning all of this property. And that is just an indication to me of the impotence of African Americans. But of course, it's another reason why I think communities like Harlem are so important. And I hadn't really thought of it this way before until Barack Obama became president. And that is, Harlem is a place which, just as a convenience to white politicians and white property owners, was designated by government and by property owners to become a black ghetto around the time of the First World War. And African Americans, since we were being relegated to this one area, African American leaders like W.B. Du Bois and James Weldon Johnson and Nail and Parker, the realtors, had the idea that we thought, well, hell, if they're going to segregate us into this one part of the city, we are going to encourage making that into a black city within the city, and we are going to show them by our enterprise and our determination what we can do, and we're going to have black institutions and black schools and black churches, and we're going to indicate how worthy we are of equality by showing the world what a great city we can create in Harlem. And so that was the effort that African Americans attempted with incredible businesses like the Renaissance Casino. But the stumbling block, which we encountered almost immediately, was the reality that capital was so much held by whites. So if it hadn't been for the numbers being able to act as an unofficial economy that gave capital to African-American businesses and other institutions, that dream that these black leaders had 100 years ago would have been a total failure. But because of the numbers and because of the determination of churches, Harlem really did, in a way, become that community that people dreamed of. It's just we didn't become that community nearly enough. And if you look at black property ownership in Harlem, it has always been relatively small compared to whites who felt that there was money to be made by exploiting this black community. So we've just had so little juice, but by being all together, massed together, that did give us this modicum of political power, because we could vote as a block that could be relied upon. And so it occurred to me when Obama was elected, I thought, well, oh my gosh, if it weren't for places like Harlem or South Central Los Angeles or Washington, D.C. or New Orleans, would it really have been possible for Obama to have been elected? So what was looked on as a negative for many years, segregation of black people, segregation due to redlining and through federal housing policy, and a refusal to back FHA housing loans for blacks who were trying to move into white communities, that all of these things really worked to give African Americans political power, which we wouldn't have had if we'd have been scattered throughout the population as a whole. And so that's how it is that I see segregation in these traditionally black communities as now being a kind of civil right to give black people political power, which we otherwise wouldn't have.
A very interesting perspective that you're presenting. And let me just say that I have a slightly different take in terms of power. I think we have had the power. I think the problem has been the lack of knowledge in some instances of what to do with that power and the will to use that power. For example, you know, in East New York, and we certainly have issues now with housing, affordable housing, all these kinds of issues. But you, in some ways, you have to have the will. So the barons, they're controversial. Some people like them, others don't. But the one thing that they've done is stood their ground on the issue of no development is coming into their district in Nice, New York, unless there is a negotiation about how that's done. And a major effort to, in fact, preserve and to maintain for, you know, working class and poor black people and even the middle class. I mean, so one doesn't see that in many elected officials for whatever reason. In fact, I'll go back to the empowerment zone concept, which I was a critic of in some ways, because there was the automatic assumption that an empowerment zone that would bring in a box store or whatever was, quote unquote, development. And I think there was well-meaning. I think many of these elected officials really meant well, but in reality, if you're displacing indigenous businesses, and if you're not finding a way to aggregate them so they can compete in various other kind of things, it's really a mistake to think that just generating more jobs in and of itself equals development, because you're really ripping apart the economic infrastructure of the community. And similarly, it seems to me in some of these areas, there is a lack of will, a lack of knowledge and will, or both, because the elected officials do have a certain amount of power that they could use to, in fact, you know, like to hang on. But on the other hand, there are so many other problems. There's always this issue, that issue. And it is happening all over the country. I mean, Atlanta.
I would agree with you to the extent that I think that, you know, that a lot of what has happened has been well-intentioned, but diluted. And the problem is, one of the problems as I see it, is that so many of these politicians, that they haven't been bold enough, and I feel like they feel they daren't be bold enough. I mean, when you look at these percentages of affordable housing versus luxury housing, that Community Board 10 in Harlem, you know, they are very careful about trying to negotiate that there'll be 20% of so-called affordable housing for all luxury housing. But it's simply not enough. It's not enough to not become overwhelmed.
That's right.
By the luxury housing.
Absolutely.
And moreover, you know, so much of this so-called affordable housing under the plans of de Blasio, it sunsets after 50 years. And people look at, you know, young people who are 18, they look at 50 years and they think that that's forever. But by the time you get to be 61, you say, oh, well, damn, 50 years, that flies by like nothing. That's nothing.
Right. That's
and,
right.
And so if it's so-called affordable now, 50 years, the blink of an eye, the time it takes for my child to grow up and get out of college, where are they going to live?
Right.
So it's horrific, these little Band-Aid measures that are offered, and that was why it was so important for me to expose de Blasio for the pseudo-progressive that he is, someone pretending to be progressive, someone who you would imagine has the best interest of the black community at heart, but in reality, all he is a tool for the developers, a classic sheep in wolf's wolf in sheep's clothing, who says one thing and says what people would like to hear, but when you look at his actions, when you look at this monumental rezoning that he is instituting throughout the city with his bizarre notion that if you create a maximum amount of luxury housing, that you will get a trickle down of affordable housing that will be adequate for the masses of people who need a place to live that they can afford. It's just a ridiculous, ridiculous notion that he has, and it just means that he's bought and paid for. No one else would even pretend to think that such a point of view was logical or reasonable or efficacious unless they were bought and paid for. And that is the thing that, as I see it, makes de Blasio worse than Bloomberg even. It's just astonishing. And it looked like he was on his way out until Trump came along, but I foresee the possibility that, you know, with Trump and his campaign pronouncements about how he was going to address the urban centers, the black urban centers,
I foresee the potentiality of a de Blasio and a Cuomo joining forces with Trump to create more charter schools and more luxury housing as a prescription to uplift black communities, which, you know, will just be the death knell
disaster,
of a place
right.
like Harlem.
Right. Well, look, I don't know whether it's possible to reverse the tide, because this is happening all over the country in the similar kinds of formulas, different kinds of things. And as you say, unfortunately, very often elected officials and leaders are complicit in it. Some of it's innocent, some of it is maybe not so innocent, but it's tragic that people are not using their power to preserve black communities. And it's not just to preserve black communities in and of themselves. It is because of this cultural heritage. It is a legacy. And as you point out in your article, and others have pointed out as well, you know, those who come into the community come in to change them. They come in to change the culture. I mean, I think you may have referenced it, others have, you know, that, you know, black people have, you know, that Marcus Garvey Park or Mount Morris Park, I forget which one is the appropriate name, where the drummers come out every Saturday, they drum, and the communities, you know, they accept it as that's a part of the community. Others move in, and that becomes noise and a problem. And so, therefore, you have a different...
There's this wonderful thing that used to happen each summer, about four times a summer. There's this guy, DJ Storman Norman, and he has these summer dance parties on a Sunday that he calls Sunday Sermon. Sunday spelled like, you know, an ice cream Sunday rather than like today. And it's just one of the coolest, most wonderful things, where people come out to dance to house music, black people, white people, old people, young people, gay people, straight people, everything. It is so incredible. But politically in Harlem, we have so little juice that these new people have come and they complain about the noise. They say that we leave trash. All of these things, which are not true. If we can't enjoy the park on a summer afternoon, then why do we pay taxes to have a park? But we have so little power, and they have so much power and white privilege, that they are able to move to Harlem and to tell us that we cannot dance in our park on a Sunday afternoon. It is appalling, just appalling, that we have so little political clout, even now.
Right.
And
right.
when you talk about the future, you know, I'm an historian, so I look back and I look at all of the social unrest that happened in terms of the creation of Harlem, because people don't realize how many little race riots and incidents occurred even as Black Harlem was forming. Before the First World War, that there were all of these racial clashes that happened continuously. Well, that hasn't been the case in Harlem in recent times with this new population, but I feel like with the police being who they are in America, that it is just inevitable that they will do something which will prompt further unrest at some point in the future. And I believe that that may have a impact upon what is happening in terms of all of this gentrification. Now, people say when I say this that I am being racist and that I'm trying to incite riot. I'm not. Nothing could be further from the truth. I'm just an historian and know how impossible it seems for people to act differently than they have acted in the past, and how people do the same dumb things, ill-advised things over and over again, and particularly when you're talking about the police, and particularly when you're looking at what has happened over the past 20 years with young African-American men and women just being treated in the most despicable way by the people whose salaries we pay. And this false claim of these people felt fear for their lives. And this happens whether the officers are black or Latino responding to other black and brown people. It's just unbelievable, the depth of racism in this country.
Right.
So that is bound to happen again, and that may be a total game changer when that sort of thing happens as it has in the past.
Well, it's great having you on, and we have to continue this conversation, and I'm going to be in touch. You probably didn't hear me earlier when I was expressing some interest in you being from Akron, Ohio, because I was saying to you, I'm from Youngstown, Ohio, and spent many years.
No, you didn't.
Yeah, and so we'll follow through on that. And
I've written books about the architecture of Ohio, so of course I've looked at Youngstown too. So
right.
Yes, Ohio is a great place to be from. I think you might agree.
Yeah, no, we'll talk because I'm a relatively new New Yorker. I've only been here now for about maybe 22 years, but most of my life and my life's work emanated out of Youngstown, Ohio, and the interface. I'm sure we know people in common because I interface with some of the major political leaders and grassroots community-based folks in Akron and all over the state of Ohio, for that matter. So I'm sure we'll find some mutual. Mutuality. This is such a great conversation. You are so knowledgeable. There's some formations that I'm working with, the Pan-African Unity Dialogue and others, where I just want to get your voice amplified in those conversations again, because this is happening all over the country, and it is sad that it's happening, and I don't know what it will take to reverse it, but it is
there's a new movie called Gentrified that addresses how this is occurring all over the country, and I'm in that little movie, and people should check it out. Go online and look for it, and whether it will be showing in their community. But yes, this is a national problem, an international problem, really, because when you look at London and the black communities there, they're being cleared out. They're taking public housing, doing the same thing they're trying to do here, taking public housing and making it into luxury housing, and then moving the poor people someplace else.
Right, absolutely. Well, Michael Henry Adams, thank you so much for spending really, really great time with this morning. Really, really highly informative. I will be back in touch with you about how we can continue this conversation in some different spaces. Again, thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
I look forward to speaking to you again. Thank you so very much.
Right. Well, whew, boy, what a powerful. I'm not trying to be self-congratulatory, but what a wonderful series of conversations we have had, beginning, you know, with Reverend Dennis Dillon and discussing, you know, economic development, the State of Economic Black World Report now, because he's moved from State of Economic Black New York to State of Economic Black World Report. It is a gorgeous report that you all need to get a copy of, and you can do that by calling 718-638-6397. That's 718-638-6397. And a trip that's going to South Africa. Reverend Dillon has been spending a lot of time on the ground in South Africa. We have been trying to figure out how to connect with some of these, both here in the country and outside, some of these African billionaires, to see whether or not some of the economic work that we're doing can be developed. I mean, there's a premise that Reverend Dillon is dealing with that really, that for many of these African entrepreneurs, their best market is the black community and beyond in the United States. In other words, they ought to be investing in tapping in a serious and organized way into this $1.7 trillion market. And so we're trying to find ways to work on it. Huge stuff, you know, that really requires young genius, brilliant minds, some of the young business leaders who are coming out. And they don't all have to be young. You could be old, too. But there's a reality about energy and effort and the kind of skills that you can devote to this work, some of it pro bono, some with sort of low-wage jobs, if you will. It's kind of things that revolutionaries do to commit of time and energy at that stage in their life. That we really need to hook up. So that was an important conversation that we continue because we've got to talk about this wealth gap. But as I mentioned to Reverend Dillon, and you know, and I'm serious about this. I'm not just interested in money for money's sake. I'm not just interested in having people who become capitalists or who become billionaires. We're looking for socially responsible, socially conscious people. This is why I go to FraserNet every year, George Fraser's Power Networking Conference, which I'll be speaking at in a couple of weeks. 65,000 black professionals. They begin with someone like Tony Broder, you know, like laying out African history. I began with a libation. I mean, he infuses the sense that we have an obligation and duty to our people and to people. That's what I'm interested in. So that Africa is the fastest growing economies is good, but it will only be good if, in fact, that growth is distributed in a way that Kwame Nkrumah and Mwalimu Nyerere and Sekou Toure and others envisioned, in terms of breaking down the structures of colonialism, breaking down the structures of enslavement, and sharing Africa's vast wealth with its own people first, and then with the world. Africa is the richest continent on the face of the earth, barring none. There's no reason why anybody in Africa should be poor. There's no reason why African people throughout the world should be weak and powerless if, in fact, Africa were sufficiently organized in terms of global black power. But that requires that the leaders, the business leaders, the political leaders have that vision. And I'm here to tell you, unfortunately, that far too few of them have that vision. Is there interruption and interference from others? Of course. But where there's a will, and Garvey said, up your mighty race, you can accomplish what you will. He didn't mean will as that you can do it. He means you can will it. You must want to do it. You must have a sense that we are going to get this done. Will power. And we see the same thing in the interview we just had with Michael Henry Adams. You know, I think that many people don't have the will of a Charles Barron, the will of an Inez Barron, and there are others. You must say, draw the line. We are not going to let this happen. Some of it is out of ignorance. And that's a problem, because we have elected officials who think they know what they don't know, then you can't hardly step to them. Same thing true of faith leaders, by the way. You know, if you got people who think God is speaking to them every morning, and even if they're spreading misinformation, you can't tell them they just spread misinformation, or they're not who they think they are because, you know, they wear that badge of, you know, divine intervention, right? Well, I say to some of them, how do you know God didn't speak to me to tell you, brother, sister, you ain't got it right? Well, it's a hard conversation. But anyway, some of it's ignorance. Some of it's just plain complicity with oppression and the spreading of these kinds of things in our community. But anyway, I'm a little off track. Dr. Rosalind Jeffries was off the hook, and we've got to bring her back for another interview. Again, the International African Arts Festival, it is the 46th anniversary. The symposium, which is sponsored by NACO, the National Association of Kawaito Organizations in New York, will be on July 1st. That's this coming July 1st, if you will. And it's 9:30 to 4:30, and it's at PS 287, and that's 50 Navy Street. It's right across the street from the venue, Commodore Park, for the International African Arts Festival, which will be July 1st through the 4th. And in order to get, the lineup is just fabulous. I mean, this is one of the wonderful things. I just wish there was a parking deck or something that you could go park your car. It's just so hard to get to it sometimes. You know, I'm having little challenges with my knees these days. But I'm going to hobble over there anyhow, if the old folks say. And I guess I'm an elder now, so I can say that. Because I just like to bathe in the beauty of the spaces and the places and the art and the culture and so many vendors. And last year I bought about 4 or 5 different samples of jerk chicken. I love jerk chicken. So a little of this, a little of that. And then hopefully my wife and partner, Mary France Daniels, may want to go this year so she can add to her repertoire of African attire. So she's now complaining that it's not adequate. So I'm going to take my baby love over there so she can now contribute to the cause. And it does. There's an admission fee. We won't say it on the air, but I always go, and whatever the minimum is, I double it, because they need the support in order to keep this moving. So do patronize the International African Arts Festival coming up. And, of course, we really want to continue this conversation, the one we had with Michael Henry Adams. What an amazing conversation that was as well. That's what we do on Vantage Point. We try to do that and to share this kind of information with you, the background and all these issues. The last one is a little perturbing, troubling, because I'm not sure what we can do about it. But we have to continue to think about it. Now, finally, crises here at WBAI, because the people who control, and you heard a an announcement about this, the people who control the signal, or they don't control it, but from which we have to rent, under duress, the signing of a contract which has led now to $50,000 a month. And the allegation, the claim that WBAI owes them $2.1 million on the lease for 3 years. Well, we need to negotiate that. And that's what the entire management, everybody is organizing to negotiate. Now, the corporation in question has gone to the judge to ask for a summary judgment. If that happens, that could be potentially very, very difficult. It's the ESB, Empire State Building, and the there's a corporation, which is in fact the one which you know is administering this. And you know, there's now a much better market rate. One that can be as little as $12,000 a month, which is much more affordable. You know how we have to come on the air and ask for your support and your help. It's an uphill battle. It ought not to be, though, frankly. I'm just having a conversation with somebody today. I'm not sure why within the progressive sphere of philanthropy, you know, somebody doesn't just drop a dime, a big dime, on WBAI and the Pacifica Network and just create a kind of endowment that would secure the future of this great resistance radio in a positive and constructive way. Anyway, we're encouraging people to call, the ESB, and you can ask for Michael Milken, I think it is. I'll get to his name here in a minute. But the switchboard is 212-687-8700. It's Anthony Milken. That's 212-687-8700. And let them know that this is not acceptable. Now, we got to figure out this for-profit corporation. I'm sure does not want its brand damaged or its enterprises interrupted. Now, that's what we got to figure out to do, because appeal to conscience within an amoral structure, I'm not sure it's going to work. Now, every now and then you'll run into somebody and say, oh, really? That WBAI? Oh, this doesn't seem fair, right? Not predatory, avaricious capitalism. I'm not sure. I think what we have to do is appeal, yes, but we've got to find the lever. What is it? Do they get subsidies from the state government? Do they get subsidies from the city government? Do they sell products that, in fact, you know, we can interrupt? Or is it the tourism that goes on a daily basis where thousands upon thousands of people visit the Empire State Building? Do they want to see hundreds of people picketing, scores of people picketing on a consistent basis, talking about the disgraceful behavior of a vicious, avaricious corporation that's trying to squelch a nonprofit organization trying to promote democracy and development? Do they want to see that? That might be the clue. Whatever it is, we have to gather our resources to confront them, because the Pacifica management is willing to negotiate, a reasonable settlement to disengage from this onerous contract, so that we can get a fair market rate out there for the signal while compensating the Empire State Building Corporation some, but not the $2.1 million. So this is about leverage. This is about exercising muscle. This is about whether or not we who believe in WBAI and Pacifica have enough resolve to figure a way, and ingenuity to figure a way, to extricate ourselves from a very, very threatening and potentially disastrous situation. They want to get this signal. They want to take it over. They have for many, many, many years. It's an incredible asset, but we ain't going to let nobody turn us around. We ain't letting nobody turn us around has got to be the battle cry. We shall not be moved. So we can make a call. That's the least that you can do at the beginning. Other information will be coming out as to how we can mobilize and organize. 212-687-8700 and request Anthony Milken, the CEO and chair of the board of the Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building and several other buildings. That's what we want to do. Well, I guess we didn't get a chance to take any calls from the audience today, but that'll happen next week, hopefully. Next week, we have a great show lined up. In the spirit of Frederick Douglass, I already got the show ready because we're going to have Patrick Delissus come back. We're going to talk about Frederick Douglass. We're going to talk about David Walker, these freedom fighters from the 19th century, and some of the others that we're going to be discussing. And then we're going to have Barbara Arnwine come on and talk about Sojourn the Truth, Harriet Tubman, and Callie House. And we're going to talk about John Brown, Martha Swan, John Brown Lives. We're going to talk all resistance next week. All resistance is going to be the spirit of what we talk about next week. So we thank you for tuning in this week to Vantage Point in conjunction with YCRadio.org. This is your moderator, the Professor Dr. Ron Daniels, and we will see you again next week here on Vantage Point.
Sugar over like a syrupy sweet. Maybe it just sags like a heavy load. Or does it explode? What happens to a dream deferred? Does it dry up like a raisin in the sun? Or fester like a sore and then run? Does it stink like rotten meat? Or crust and sugar over like a syrupy sweet.
For WBAI in New York, I'm Linda Perry. Our listener-sponsored non-commercial radio station, as well as our parent organization, the Pacifica Radio Network, is under attack from one of New York City's cultural icons, Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building. It filed a motion against WBAI Pacifica Radio, claiming that we owe $2.1 million, and it wants to hold the station to a lease until 2020. We want to be released from the next 3 years of the lease. The case goes to the judge on June 30th. After 9/11, Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building, took advantage of their virtual monopoly on good antenna space. Our foundation's executive director at the time was forced to sign an unconscionable contract to stay on the air. Our antenna rent has now gone up to over $50,000 a month, four times the market rate. In the meantime, new tower space has come available for $12,000 a month. WBAI wants to be released from the next 3 years of the lease and negotiate a fair settlement.
The answer from the Empire State Building officials was that we should sell our WBAI license or trade it for one with a much smaller coverage area.
Bill Crozier is Pacifica Foundation's executive director.
In other words, they suggested that we cannibalize our signal in the largest media market in the country, so they could earn excessive profits. We told them that we clearly could not do that.
You can join other listeners expressing their views about this crisis by calling 212-687-8700 and ask for Anthony Malkin. He's the CEO and board chair of Empire State Realty Trust, which owns the Empire State Building. You can express your views. Again, that's 212-687-8700. Ask for Anthony Malkin. And you may want to contact your city council members and local and state representatives to step in on behalf of WBAI. Many thanks.
Here in New York City, you're tuned to 99.5 FM, WBAI, and WBAI.org. My name is Michael G. Haskins. Let me give you that number again, 212-687-8700.